Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, the sweeping proposal to overhaul funding to local governments and save Milwaukee from insolvency is one step closer from becoming law. Plus, lawmakers also approved legislation to increase state funding for public and private schools, and the push by Wisconsin's top Republican to dismantle UW campus funding for diversity offices. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for June 16th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Well, J.R., it was quite the week at the state capitol, and almost historic in a sense, because after months of negotiations, weeks of making tweaks to the shared revenue plan, and which pairs with the education package, they finally got it done. The Assembly and Senate passed the sweeping proposal this week, and also they had those bills passed related to K-12 spending and increasing payments to charter schools. So this legislation would pump an additional $275 million into state aid for local governments, known as shared revenue. And this clears the way for this bill to now to head to Governor Tony Evers' desk. Like we've talked about all along, a big component of this bill also will provide a new sales tax for Milwaukee County and the city to address their pension obligations by raising their sales tax. And this will also avoid a massive blow to their state budget. We talked about the multiple cuts that they've already had to make to some police, but there was potentially closing libraries and cutting fire departments. The most interesting thing, I think, that a lot of us reporters were watching is who was going to vote for the plan and who was going to vote against the plan. We saw in the Senate, Democrats, six of them actually helped Republicans in passing it. Meanwhile, in the Assembly, it was kind of mixed. You had some Democrats voting for it, but according to my count, I counted 13 in both chambers from the Milwaukee area, Democrats voted against the deal. Now, one of the co-authors, Senator Mary Falskowski, kind of touted this as a win for Wisconsin, a win for Milwaukee to solve them from going into bankruptcy. Meanwhile, Democrats maintained that this wasn't a good deal because of the series of provisions that I'm going to get to in a little bit that are tied to this bill. Let's take a listen from both sides on the issue.
A public hearing was held in the committee on an old bill, knowing that it was going to change. A vote was held on that bill, knowing it was going to change. And we didn't get this amendment till sometime after lunch. This Frankenstein's monster of a bill should be slaughtered today.
This is a win. It's a win for the 12th Senate District with no communities over the size of 9,000. It's a win for Madison. It's a win for Milwaukee. It's not perfect, but let's not let perfect get in the way of very, very good.
Let's also first recap those provisions, which, like I mentioned, many Democrats disliked. The one specifically that target Milwaukee would require them to put back 25 armed police officers at Milwaukee Public Schools. They would also ban using state funding on Milwaukee streetcar. It would also remove power from the city's fire and police commission. Now, there's also a list of statewide conditions that would apply to every municipality. They would have to maintain police and fire and staffing levels or be at risk of losing funding. They also could not consider race when awarding contracts. That kind of deals with the ongoing battle about DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion efforts that Republicans dislike. It would also increase transparency at the parole commission meetings. It would restrict local advisory referendums in some way. And it would prevent public health officers' ability to close businesses during a health emergency. Now, I want to go back to the votes because it was pretty dynamic. And it was interesting to see kind of both sides cross party lines to get this done when we know it was a bipartisan compromise between Governor Evers and GOP leaders.
So we talked about some outstate Republicans who were having concerns about the bill in the Senate. And the math. There is typically a rule of 17 in the Senate, which means you have to have 17 GOP votes to pass anything. That rule is enforced unless you really don't want to enforce it. That's the funny thing about rules and politics. When you're in charge, you write the rules and you break the rules. Here you had a situation where you had seven Republicans who were not going to vote for the bill, and Devin Lemahieu, the Senate Bill Leader, decided to roll the dice because he knew he'd get Democrats. that the governor could pressure enough Democrats to get them across the finish line, because you had the situation where if you want to get two more Republican votes, you'd have to give something up. Well, this is a deal worked out between LeMahieu, Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, and the governor. If you change it, you threaten to upend the deal. I kind of wonder going in if the Democrats who would be needed to get across the finish line would ask for something, like say, okay, we're empowered here, we have leverage. The governor, though, from what I was told, was calling members, or at least the staff, were saying, we need help. This is a deal we struck. We need to get this across the finish line. We need you to pitch in. So the Democrats, there was this weird pause during the debate on Wednesday. They caucused for like 20 minutes right for the final vote. They realized, well, they kind of knew, but okay, we are going to carry this across the finish line. Let's talk about this for a second. What's going on here, and kind of assess the situation. Realized they couldn't ask for something, because if you ask for something, you could maybe upend the entire thing. Fascinating dynamic. Also, those provisions about Milwaukee we talked about, there were some provisions added in the amendment. Most of the amendment reflects the deal that Evers reached with GOP leaders. There are a couple of things, though, that are harsher for Milwaukee now. For example, there are target numbers of how many firefighters, police, and detectives you have to have. There's now a 10-year deadline. You have to hit that mark within 10 years. On top of that, there's a new hammer for Milwaukee. You mentioned the cut in, if you don't meet maintenance efforts, you get a cut in your shared revenue, right? There's an extra bridge for Milwaukee. If you fail to make that, there's an extra cut that you would get under this deal. That's going to cause some more heartburn for Milwaukee about this, because they're already unhappy about the provisions about DEI and other things. Oh, by the way, there's a brewer package coming before too long. That is going to make it even harder to swallow the idea of a local contribution if you have these additional provisions added on to you as a City of Milwaukee resident or official.
Right, that is a big question that we even heard from Voss, that he wants to get that package done before the 4th of July. Oh, by the way, they also want to get a budget done before the 4th of July, of course. What's interesting, too, looking ahead, is now how does the county and City Council of Milwaukee, the boards, come together and pass this by a two-thirds vote? You also have to think about the timeline here, because, you know, talking to some Milwaukee leaders and officials, they want to get this done soon. And some of the main reasons are is because a sales tax, when the RNC is in Milwaukee in 2024, would muster quite a lot of money for the city and county. Also, there's an election next year. Mayor Cavalier Johnson is up for re-election. Same with David Crowley, the county executive, is up. So they want to get this done, these votes over with, so it's not lingering over them. So that's just another thing I wanted to point out. Now let's kind of talk about the education package, because this on Friday, a week ago, we talked about the details of what we heard was in the bill. That then we actually got to read the bill later that day, and then there was more public hearings and debates. And what was most surprising is that teacher unions, who are usually pretty best buds with the governor, were pretty upset with this deal. Mm-hmm. And the main reason was because they believed conservatives got the better part of the deal by private school vouchers received more money per pupil compared to public schools per pupil. Now, this would overall increase funding for both of them. And the numbers that I'm looking at, it would provide $1 billion for K-12 schools, and it amounts to about a $325 increase per student. Meanwhile, the increase for private school vouchers, it would increase the dollar amount from roughly about $10,000 to $11,000 per student. Now, the speeches on the floor were pretty passionate about this, and one thing that was interesting was Senator LaTanya Johnson. She was one of the Democrats that felt like she had to vote for this plan. But she described it, as she did earlier in the week on Joint Finance, that she didn't like how these negotiations went down. So in a sense, you had a bunch of lawmakers saying, I don't like this, but I feel like I have to vote for this. So let's also take a listen from her comments and Senator Dewey Strobel, who was one of the co-authors of this bill, kind of just basically saying, this is what a compromise is all about. Let's take a listen.
Children who attend both of these schools, they require and deserve a basic level of support. And that's what this bill does, a basic level of support for two very diverse types of schools, public schools, private schools. Not all of our public schools are doing the job that they should. Some are doing a very terrible job, quite frankly. And I don't want to see another generation in certain parts of our state be subjected and only have their only choice is to go to a failing school.
I have a choice school on the corner of my house. That is not quality. So if you are allowing choice schools like that to enter the system and to receive dollars, then you're not providing our kids with a choice at all. Governor Evers, he had a gun to his head. Either he gave my colleagues what they wanted, or Milwaukee went into insolvency, and he chose to save Milwaukee.
So both these bills, education, local government funding aid, is going to be heading to Governor Evers' desk. No idea when he's going to sign them, but we can anticipate that he is going to sign them. He signaled on Twitter in a statement on Wednesday that he got kind of what he wanted. Of course, the bill is not perfect, like we even heard from Senator Falskowski there, that this is now time to move on, and there'll be a lot more focus now on budget, Brewers, many more stuff to get done off their list. There was also more of a rift on DEI funding this week from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Governor Tony Evers. So let's start with kind of what happened at the beginning, which is on Tuesday, Joint Finance was anticipated to take up funding for the UW system. Shortly before that, Voss told the AP that, well, I want to cut $32 million from the UW system so they can't use this funding on diversity hires or anything that does with DEI efforts. The next day, Governor Evers was in Monroe and on a visit at a cheese factory and said, well, if he's going to do that, I'm going to veto the entire budget. If that were to happen, I mean, that would delay them passing the budget on time. We've talked about the timeline before, how long lawmakers kind of have until things almost kind of look a little worrisome for schools when it comes to October, et cetera, this fall. So then on Thursday, Voss says, well, I'm actually open to even deeper cuts, he told reporters after a meeting on the Rules Committee. And we haven't heard from the governor yet. I reached out for a statement saying, what do you think about this? Don't know if the veto threat is still there, I would assume. But that just kind of really changes the dynamic going forward. And we still don't know when Joint Finance is going to take up UW funding, because on Tuesday, it appeared that Senate Republicans didn't even have the votes at that time. And they're not going to bring up an issue unless they know it can pass.
So here's the backdrop of this. The university system has own position authority. So lawmakers and most agencies say, we're going to cut this job, that job, whatever. With UW, they can't target the DEI positions because they don't have that authority. They can just cut funding. The money that Robin is talking about is actually the pot of money being spent on any position that has DEI in the title or is associated with it. We asked for a list of these jobs a couple months ago at WisPolitics. There were about 185 administrators. That's about $13.5 million a year. The 16 that he's talking about a year, $32 million over the budget, includes professors, associate professors, instructors. So it's not just administrators, it's people teaching anything related to DEI. Asked him, okay, are you trying to prevent the teaching? Like, what are you talking about? He's like, look, this doesn't touch the entire pot of money going to DEI. The programming, those kinds of things, it's beyond that. They got a chance to change their ways. They didn't do it. We're going to try and cut it. Now, the governor's threat, what I want to know is, okay, he's threatened vetoes before the budget,
right?
Not done it. If you threaten, I'll veto it at $32 million, what if it's $30 million or $28 or $26? Does that then somehow give him, okay, I can sign that. If it's $32 and he signs it, what's his veto threat mean going forward at all, right? If he does veto the entire thing, it's vetoing over $32 million of a billions and billions spent in the budget. This is kind of a little bit of an interesting gamesmanship. Also, the Senate wasn't there on $32 million. Robin kind of threw a stink bomb into the joint finance process by announcing this that morning, which is why it was put off. We assume finance is going to finish on Tuesday. They have taxes, pay for state employees, and a couple other things, including UW, to finish up. Long day coming on Tuesday.
Yes, indeed.
If they can reach a deal on these things. That's what I'm kind of watching. And again, with Governor Evers, I'd like to ask him, how serious are you about a veto? And what if you don't veto it? Then what? Then how do they view you going forward as somebody that they have to work with or be afraid of in the process of doing stuff like this.
And this is all part of the ongoing rift that Voss has had with UW system. We also heard from Senator Nass, who is, I would say, for many, many years, has never really liked what the UW system has been doing and has wanted to see some dramatic changes there. All right, speaking of joint finance, let's quickly just recap what they took action on Tuesday and Thursday. Friday morning was a very, very late night. You're still here, JR. Let's recap that. So the early Friday morning, they ended funding to the pandemic era child care subsidy program. And Democrats and a lot of care providers kind of warned that the move would be devastating for needy families and the state's economy. Then on Tuesday, they increased transit funding by 2% over the biennium. But Democrats, again, argue that that is not enough, especially for places like Milwaukee that are facing a public transit budget shortfall. So these are just still some things. It's always going to be the heat of the argument that we see these things going on. Now I'm going to toss to, we sat down with Republican state chair, or excuse me, Brian Schimming, the chair of the Republican Party, They have a state convention this weekend. Let's just take a listen to that interview of them previewing of what we can expect. Brian, thank you so much for joining us. So looking ahead to this state convention this weekend, what can we expect? What are the themes? What can we expect to hear?
We'll be talking a lot about grassroots. We're doing training a good share of the day Friday for grassroots folks across the state. We'll be doing training sessions from the stage as well to the whole crowd, to the whole convention crowd. So it'll be about that. It'll be about unity. It will be about the fact that, as I always say, Wisconsin is not one of 50 states next year. We're one of five. The plain truth of the matter is Wisconsin's one of five states. Wisconsin, Georgia, Arizona, whoever else you want to name, but certainly Wisconsin's in the top five. It's why the Republican National Convention is coming here. It's why the first debate is here. And I look forward to that, and the polling numbers tell me I should.
So, Brian, is there any kind of a pick yourself off the mat kind of like thing you have to do? Because looking back to 16, since Trump and Johnson won in that year, it's been 14 of 17 races the Democrats have won. The exceptions are Hagedorn, and then last fall, Johnson and Labor. So do you have to kind of rally the troops of, like, let's get kind of back up and ready for another fight?
Well, the convention's always about rallying the troops, but I'm not on the mat. I mean, in 2022, the two incumbents who won in Wisconsin, the two Democrat incumbents, were incumbents and very well funded by sources from out of state. Otherwise, in 2022, I think there's a little bit of a whatever out there about this, because in 2022, other than those two races, which is hard to say, I'd rather have Governor Michaels and Attorney General Tony right now, obviously, but we ran the table. We ran the table in this state. Let's make sure people are clear. We ran the table in this state in 2022 in the U.S. Senate race where Ron Johnson, who everyone was saying wouldn't win again for the third time in a row, where Ron Johnson had $100 million dropped on him from in the state and out of the state. He was the top Senate candidate in the country. Why aren't people asking the Democrats why they spent $100 million against the most unpopular senator of the Republican caucus in the polling and lost? We picked up two assembly seats and almost a supermajority. We did pick up a supermajority in the Senate, as you noted, the state treasurer's race as well, and picked up one of the congressional seats that put Republicans in the majority in the House. So I don't consider myself on the mat. Now, are there some races I would have liked to have won? Well, yeah, there's a couple races I would have liked to have won. And I would think that the U.S. Senate race and the treasurer's and others in western Wisconsin are races the Democrats would have liked to have won, but they didn't.
Now, conventions are also talking about strategies, looking ahead, looking back at elections, maybe what worked, what didn't work. We also heard from you and Senator Ron Johnson last election cycle talking about getting more people to vote early,
right.
You know, submitting those absentee ballots to compete with Democrats who widely are enjoy doing that before Election Day. So are you still emphasizing those strategies, and what else are you hoping to work on in the future?
Still and more, actually. I was just in Washington for a couple of days last week. Look, as I've said, and I've spoken to both of you, you can't keep going into Election Day 200,000 votes down and make it up in 13 hours. It's that simple. It's plain arithmetic. And I did some shows in Washington last week, and I've been talking to national leaders. I've been one of the first state chairs in the country to talk pretty publicly about the issue of needing to have early vote. An interesting number, I think, on early vote is that the Democrats have been out early voting us, requesting, about 2-1. But when our people get their early ballot, their absentee ballot, they return it at a factor of like 90%, which is almost exactly the same as the Democrats. So if I can get conservative voters or Republican, you know, right of center voters in the state to request absentee ballots, I'm going to get their vote. 9 times out of 10, it gets returned. You don't need to be a math major to figure out where that takes us. And so for me, it's going to be a campaign about early vote, about ballot security, and especially in Wisconsin, where, as you know, you request an early ballot for all the elections next year. You can vote in the February primary, or you'll get an early ballot, I should say, in the February primary, in the April general, and then again in the fall. So I'm going to be encouraging them to do that, and that will be part of my convention speech this weekend, and you'll hear it from Ron Johnson and the rest of the congressional delegation, too. There's no turning back, and I'm going to say to the party, we can walk and chew gum at the same time, and we're going to do more than that.
Brian, where is the party headed as a base? I was at the convention last year, and Paul Ryan was booed. If you had told me a decade earlier Paul Ryan would ever be booed at a Jubilee convention, I thought you're crazy, but it did happen. Robin Voss has does have some fans that come to a convention these days. Are you guys becoming more of a populist party? Are you losing that kind of Paul Ryan type person? Like, where are you guys headed, and what's your math to be successful going forward in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so I keep telling people, look, I want to broaden the base of the party, because the truth of the matter is, if we talk to voters on right of center issues in this state, we're in the majority. If Paul Ryan or Robin Voss has an occasional critic, or even more than occasional critics, that's great. Only a third of the Democrats in this state want Joe Biden to run for re-election. That is a staggeringly bad number from any pollster in the country. We'll tell you that, and Wisconsin reflects the rest of the country. So if somebody's got a problem, it's not some grassroots folks who have legitimate concerns maybe about Robin Voss or about a guy who has not been speaker for years. Mm-hmm. The Democrats' problem is much, much bigger than ours, and that is their own, as you know, the state Democratic Party wouldn't allow a poll of their own delegates on what they thought of Joe Biden in the presidential race. That's a disaster. They're polling in this state on their incumbent president who has to carry them to victory is a disaster, and that is a drag on the ticket, and every poll out there shows it.
Now, you're entering this convention still without a candidate to go toe-to-toe with Democrat incumbent Tammy Baldwin.
Right.
We also just heard not too long ago that Congressman Gallagher decided to not run, which kind of, I guess, will start opening the fences, per se, for candidates to start lining in. Can we expect maybe any of the possible names that have been tossed out there making stump speeches? Or is there maybe even going to be a big announcement this weekend?
I'm not anticipating a big announcement, but if there was an announcement, that would be a big announcement. A really big announcement. But Eric Hovde will be there. Steve Meyer out of Milwaukee will be there. Obviously, Congressman Tiffany will be there. So there's, as you know, there's 4 or 5 names kind of in play out there. There are a couple that are not, that are looking from afar at the race. So I don't suspect that. I don't think that happens this weekend. But I think, and I would have loved to have Mike Gallagher in the race. He's a friend. But we have other potential candidates there. And to your point, I think now that Mike Gallagher is, who might have had right of first refusal, for lack of a better phrase, maybe, that helps free up others to make decisions. And I've heard that a couple times this week, that folks are going, okay, we know what that table looks like as far as Mike Gallagher. So that probably, I'd be surprised if we got through the next 30 to 60 days without knowing something more delicate. But have me back in 60 days. I might have to walk that back.
All right, let's get to stock picks this week. And rising is school property taxes, because mm-hmm. they go in pair with the overhaul of school funding bill that we saw this week.
So you mentioned the advocates who are unhappy with Evers and the deal he struck. One thing I heard at the hearing really kind of struck me and people I talked to was the president of the Milwaukee Teachers Association said, I could have gotten this deal from Scott Walker. That is not true. The reason it's not true is because this package would raise school property taxes by more than $600 million, almost $650 million, over the next 2 years. Scott Walker, Republicans, when he was in charge, were obsessed with the property tax bill. They forced money into the system to drive down property tax. Remember, there are two big pots of aids for schools. There's categorical aids, which are not subject to the revenue limits. They're like per pupil, various things. There's the general aids, the big pot of money. That pot of money has the per pupil cap of how much you can spend,
It's a mix of state money and property taxes. The more state money you put in, the less property taxes you can put in. We got the number last week of the $1 billion in spendable money for schools. We didn't know, though, the mix of state money versus property taxes. Now we know. The question to ask, though, is what are they going to do, Republicans, to blunt that impact?
Right.
If you're talking about a $7 billion surplus and you're going to allow property taxes to go up by that much, you better do something big to, like, make the base happy. So Mark Bourne, the co-chair of the committee, said during the hearing on Tuesday that the whole thing's not done yet, the whole package of property taxes, because you have schools are the biggest part. You have tech colleges. You have local governments. Like, there's other stuff coming. There are credits you can do. So watch that piece of it. And then, two, we keep hearing that they're about how much we're spending at every executive session. There's about $2 billion in the second year to spend above current levels. That's your pot of money to watch on Tuesday or early Wednesday. They finish the tax package and raises for state employees. That's how big the tax cut can be, unless you want to create a structural deficit, which they can do. But they might do some one-time stuff in the first year, so they still have a pot of cash laying around. But that's giving you a little guide of what your tax cut's going to be going forward from Republicans' tax stuff.
And a mix this week is state troopers who finally get a raise, but there's not new positions.
Yes. So first, the troopers have been behind in terms of pay compared to their peers for years. The Evers administration, a few years ago, tried to do a major catch-up, a double-digit increase. It got rejected. They still got a healthy raise, but not what they wanted. They got a raise now. It's a two-year contract, basically. The funny thing is, it ends in 14 days. So their contracts run through June 30th, an odd-numbered year. If they want to get back to be normal, like I get a raise in January of this coming year, they have a new contract in the next 6 months. The lawmakers, also the Joint Finance Committee, nixed an Evers idea to add about three dozen trooper positions for traffic patrol. Basically, there are a bunch of vacancies at State Patrol right now. So, like, you got vacancies. We're going to give you more jobs going forward.
All right. And falling this week, let's get into the weeds. I know that you love to do this. It's over a Supreme Court decision over, collegiality.
So, how many times, Emily, have you read a Supreme Court ruling in the last few years in which the end of it had a justice calling on her colleagues to resign? Okay. Here's the setup. This is there's a lawsuit that's been pending over Madison schools and its policy on transgender students. Basically, if you are transitioning, you can use pronouns that you prefer, and they can't tell your parents unless you get authorization from the student. There have been lawsuits that have gone back and forth about whether the Supreme Court could take the case directly, first that was that, or bypass Court of Appeals. Last month, the court rejected the request to bypass Court of Appeals. Happens all the time. What I've never seen before is they amended that order this week to allow Rebecca Bradley, conservative, to add her two cents to respond to Brian Hagedorn. In Hagedorn's ruling, it was a concurrence action. So the court, when they vote on rejecting petitions like this, it's basically an order. There's not really a full discussion of why. Hagedorn wrote a concurrence saying, look, we are getting too many requests for original action, which is the court taking it directly, not going through the lower courts first. I think he's pointed out to, in the years before he joined the court, it was rare. We're getting so many of them now. We're granting too many. Let's go back to normal order of circuit court, appeals court, us. It allows a record to be developed. We're the court to tackle big law, legal issues, or theoretical stuff, not these record developing. Bradley was unhappy because he took shots at the conservatives who want to take the case, saying, look, you guys have all these cases you want to take. One case, the Ivermectin case we talked about a few weeks ago, the court ruled 6-1 against the guy petitioning his uncle get the drug. So look, you want to take this case directly, we ruled 6-1. Here's an example of why we should not be taking these cases. Bradley wrote a 16-page dissent ripping Brian Hagedorn up and down, suggested that he was sexist. Actually, the quote was, he laced his concurrence with vaguely sexist suggestions by three female colleagues. He amended his opinion to add a footnote saying, I'm not going to deal with this writing because it abandons the basic judicial decorum. What's really interesting is the part of Sawyer Wynn, the Supreme Court in April, she talked about her values a lot, right? Bradley finished her dissent, and I want to read this directly, talking about values. Didn't mention his part of Sawyer at all, who joins the court in August. But wrote, there is but one overriding value judges should espouse in the campaign trail and in the performance of judicial duties, supporting the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Wisconsin in defense of the people's liberty. The majority should revisit the judicial oath and resign if unwilling to fulfill it.
Mm.
Now, what's this mean going forward? We are going to have a new liberal majority come August, 4 liberals, 3 conservatives. So while Brian has been at times the one saying we shouldn't take cases because he joins his liberal colleagues to do it, now it matters what Janet and the other 3 liberals want to do. 2, what's Rebecca Bradley going to do? She has written these fiery dissents at times. We're just going to amp it up even more in the minority, the true minority, going forward. And for lawyers, this is like, it's like catnip to read this kind of stuff. Like, it's just like the feuds of the court. That's also a lack of decorum. They're really taking personal shots at each other in these public writings is really kind of an interesting twist for the court.
Definitely. All right, that will do it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Rewind, Your Week in Review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.